you some help right now. You're listening to the Guy James Show on the Head On Radio Network. And don't forget, you've heard from the radical right. Now all that's left is the truth.
Southern Afghanistan, a hostage murdered by the Taliban in connection with their unmet demands that the Afghan government release Taliban prisoners from its jails. Negotiations for the release of the remaining 21 hostages are stalled. Taliban leaders have set a new deadline for midday tomorrow, threatening to kill at least one more hostage if their demands aren't met. In Kabul, a car bomb attack injured 3 coalition troops and 3 Afghan civilians who were part of a convoy. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and Defense Secretary Robert Gates are in the Middle East to gain support for the U.S. position on war in Iraq. More than $20 billion in military aid has so far been promised to U.S. Arab allies. Russia, meantime, plans to give Iran $1 billion in military aid, in part to balance the U.S. multi-billion-dollar arms package to other Arab nations. The United Nations will soon vote on whether or not to send a peacekeeping force to Sudan's western region of Darfur. The controversial resolution is co-sponsored by Britain and France and would provide 26,000 additional troops to the area. The White House nominee to head the Joint Chiefs of Staff told the Senate today that Iraq's lagging political progress is hurting American credibility. Navy Admiral Michael Mullen also testified that Iran's regional aspirations are bolstered by the country's continuing security problems after more than 4 years of war. U.S. Supreme Court Justice John Roberts walked out of a hospital this morning after suffering a mild seizure yesterday at his summer home in Maine. Roberts was hospitalized overnight as a precaution. A threatened White House veto looms over legislation which would increase health insurance for the nation's low-income children. A 61-cent increase in the federal excise tax on each package of...
And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. If you've been watching the Gonzalez testimony, you might not catch the secret subtext. They talk about whether he's committing perjury and, of course, how he's violating the Constitution. That we all know. But the secret subtext, the inside scoop, if you will, on what's really going on in the U.S. prosecutor scandal is who they hired and who they fired. And if you go through the list, you find out that the people they fired were U.S. prosecutors who refused the demands of someone at the White House, most probably Karl Rove, to look into and to prosecute those registering African Americans to vote. See, there's nothing Republicans hate more than African Americans voting. 90% of them vote for Democrats, and Republicans just won't have that. So they've tried very, very hard to prevent blacks from registering, much like the Jim Crow people did in the past. And when prosecutors won't prosecute for fraud, then they're ousted. It should be noted that there's never been a case of major voting fraud in this country from the voters. The voting fraud has only come from the other side, from those that would manipulate the machines. So if you look at that and you notice that the people being fired are those that wouldn't prosecute voting organizations, and those that were hired, most specifically Bradley Schlossman in Missouri, who, despite the fact that the Justice Department says you're not supposed to bring election lawsuits right before an election, did exactly that. Rushed so fast that he even misspelled someone's name, got it into the press, he got into that Republican candidate, and lo and behold, the Democrats still won the election in Missouri. Of course, Claire McCaskill beat Jim Talent, and we have the majority in the Senate. But if you note, the common theme in all of these things, whether it's science and the way that Bush wants politicization over that or anything else, is that they want power. There's nothing the Republicans, there's nothing this administration wants more than power. They're willing to sacrifice our Constitution. They're willing to sacrifice our values. They're willing to sacrifice everything to get it. So the clear concern for me, and frankly for any American who's had their eyes open since 2000, is will our elections be free and fair? Will the Diebold election machines, will they again be able to manipulate election results? Will there be paper records such as the Rush-Holt bill to have paper verification or some even better standard? Will we have hanging chads like in Florida again? Now, some of you may think I'm obsessed on this topic, and indeed, if you look through the broadcast archive of Radio Inside Scoop, you'll probably find I have done more stories on the right to vote and the freedom to vote and the trickiness of election machinery, I think, than any other topic I've ever done. Maybe the Iraq War would rival it in topics. But that's because I got into politics because of Bush v. Gore. I started leaving my job as a trial lawyer and coming to Washington because I was concerned about the right to vote. The right to vote, of course, is the right upon which all our other rights is based. I mean, whatever your views on abortion or gun control or civil rights or the environment or education, the war in Iraq, whatever your views on any issue, taxes, your right to vote is more important. Because if you have no right to choose your elected representatives, all the other rights are subsidiary. So I'm doing yet another show on election machinery. But this one will be a little different. I'm interviewing Jonathan Simon. He's the co-founder of the Election Defense Alliance. And I think you'll find he has a somewhat different take from some of the others. If you want to call in, feel free to do so. The toll-free number is 888-488-MARK or 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-4-H-E-A-D-O-N. Let me start my interview with Jonathan Simon.
I'm talking now with Jonathan Simon. He is the co-founder of the Election Defense Alliance. Mr. Simon, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thank you, Mark.
Now, the Election Defense Alliance, this is one of the newer vote-protecting organizations. We've heard from a lot of them on the Inside Scoop. Not that you should necessarily be different from the others, Bev Harris and others that are working hard to protect people's right to vote. But what is the specific strategy and talent of the Election Defense Alliance?
Well, Election Defense Alliance, Mark, was born on the 4th of July of last year, 2006, after, you know, quite a few months of strategizing and thinking about what was needed. And one of the things that we realized, co-founders and some of the people who were early on board, was that there was a lot of, there was diversity, but there was a lack of coordination among a lot of the groups that were working for election integrity, and especially geographically. I mean, there were a lot of local groups that were didn't know about each other, were reinventing the wheel in many cases, couldn't combine their resources or efforts, and that was the original idea of Election Defense Alliance.
So you're coordinating all these other organizations that exist, trying to bring them together for one cause.
Yes, of course, what we found was that a lot of organizations don't particularly want to be coordinated. You know, there's a pretty significant
two progressives
value.
Have three opinions, perhaps.
Exactly, and there's a lot of, you know, a lot of autonomy issues and whatnot. So we've morphed as time has gone on, and, you know, we have coordinating functions. We also have education functions. We have what I guess would pass for some lobbying or advocacy functions.
And we have research functions.
And we have research
functions. One of the things that strikes me is we've done a lot of shows. I got started in this business because of 2000. That's an easy one to prove, the stolen election. 2004 is a bit harder to show, but we certainly have had discussions on that. What your organization is saying is that the 2006 election was rigged. Now, people who listen to my show know well about Vern Buchanan and that election in Florida. You don't have to convince any of us that that was a rigged election. But your organization is making a stronger point, a wider point.
Yes. Well, with a little bit of history, I mean, I was the fellow who actually downloaded the exit polls in 2004. I sat in front of my computer at a time when I don't think many people, you know, realized what was going to be going down.
Warren Mitofsky.
But I had a relationship of sorts with Warren Mitofsky, the late Warren Mitofsky. We had a conversant relationship. And through, because at one point I was a polling analyst for Peter Hart, and quite some years back. But I had the experience, and that gave me access to Warren and the official exit polling that was being done.
For those that don't know, just so we're clear, Warren Mitofsky was such a respected pollster that in the Ukrainian election, when he did the polls for that and the ex-communist candidate said he won, but Warren Mitofsky's polls showed that, in fact, that his challenger had won, enough people marched in the streets that they were practically ready to burn down the parliament there.
Yeah, I mean, the irony was that Ukraine and the United States, the two elections were happening pretty much simultaneously. They were both shifted or rigged by about the same amount, and you saw completely different reactions. Of course, the Ukrainian reaction seemed to have a little bit of stimulus coming from the United States itself through the CIA and whatnot to get them out in the streets, whereas in the U.S., the media basically shut down and locked down everything and made sure that the word did not spread. To the extent it spread at all, it was going around the blogs and around the Internet.
So what is the difference? I mean, Ukraine is, okay, a newer democracy. People care more. They're marching in the streets more. Orange Revolution. Why can't Americans march in the streets? Why weren't they marching in the streets in 2000? I mean, the only revolution we seem to have seen was the Brooks Brothers Revolution, where Tom DeLay's people were marching in Miami to prevent counting of votes. I do remember Jesse Jackson started to get a few people out in 2000 until they found some dirt on him and tried to keep him quiet. Why don't we march?
Well, you hit many of the high notes. First of all, the United States is an old democracy. It's a democracy where you and I and most people of any generation that we're familiar with were born into a democracy, taking it for granted, recognizing that the hard work had already been done with Jefferson and Madison and Hamilton, and that it was just ours for the taking. And the complacency level is very high. The taking for granted level is very high. It's a bit of an arthritic democracy in the sense that people, their idea of participation in democracy is basically going and voting, if that. That's a far cry from a place like the Ukraine, where they have not had the experience of democracy and therefore value it very, very highly. The other thing is that, I mean, I don't know if you were at the inauguration in 2000.
I was, actually. In fact, a guy next to me was throwing urine, actually, at the president and was arrested. I didn't go that far, but I definitely was screaming.
Well, I was there, too, and that makes two of us. But from my observation, and I'm actually...
It was a very cold day.
It was a cold and rainy day.
Rainy sleet.
It was not an easy day
to
come out.
It wasn't.
And there were 50,000 protesters there. As you know, that finally
came out.
They
had to speed the car up so fast that the Secret Service agent had to sprint to catch
up
with it.
For those people who have watched Fahrenheit 9/11, you know, that was probably the first glimpse they had what actually went on Inauguration Day. So what we found is we were down there, we were screaming, we were protesting, we were outraged, and the newspapers and the networks and any form of mainstream media in this country basically made us all disappear. It went away. The accounts when I got home were a couple of thousand, if that. Some
right.
Talked about hundreds of protesters. We were basically disappeared.
I think it was actually more than 50,000, the numbers I saw. One thing I did notice...
A minimum.
Well, I'll tell you
that's
this. I was talking throughout the crowd, and I found there are more people protesting the inauguration than supporting the inauguration. And I talked, I mean, just in
oh,
my...
Oh, by a factor of 20 to 1, at least.
And
at least.
There were very, very few supporters, and that was a fact that never made the newspapers.
Well, the supporters got to sit in the grandstand.
They
but
got
we
in the bleachers.
Looked at them, too.
Right.
You know, there were a couple of thousand of them.
Right.
That's fine.
Right.
But there was an army of protesters
there.
Now, they used helicopter guidance. What they did is they would siphon people off into sort of places, and then they'd block them in there. This was all very coordinated to basically diffuse the march and make sure that people couldn't congregate all together. And in spite of all those efforts, when you watch, you know, 9/11, Fahrenheit 9/11, you can see how powerful that protest was, how massive it was. So from that point on, well, I pretty much knew, and it sounds like you got religion sort of almost around the same time.
I left my trial job in Los Angeles, moved to Washington, and decided to make a difference.
Yeah, and I have a parallel path, and we realized that we were in for it. Because whatever the truth was not going to be broadcast, was not going to come out. And that was also the case in the situation in 2002 election, and very much so in 2004, and again in 2006.
Tell me what happened in 2006, because my listeners are well familiar with 2000 and 2004 as well.
Yeah.
06, less so.
Well, having downloaded the poll, the exit polls in 2004 and gotten that started, I realized I wanted to do something, and we from Election Defense Alliance wanted to do something more efficient in 2006. So we actually set up a war room in the Philadelphia area, and we had a bunch of computers hooked up. We had some of our own polls going. But we were very surprised when we saw that the official exit polls, again, Edison Matofsky, commissioned by the networks and the Associated Press, actually were posting unadjusted exit poll figures, which means authentic exit poll numbers that had not been adjusted to match the vote counts. And these were stratified. They were demographically stratified to the best of the pollster's ability, and these guys have a pretty high-end operation.
Before you continue, I think it's important for people to realize, because I don't think most people do, that polls after the fact are adjusted to reflect the official figures. Most people don't realize this, that there are polls, for example, the ones that show that Kerry beat Bush, at about midnight or so on November 2004, you know this better than I do.
I was there.
They literally removed votes from the exit polls and moved votes around to reflect the, quote, official results, unquote, right?
Yes, and I can tell you that, you know, when people hear about that, they think, wow, this is an incredibly sinister conspiracy. It's actually fairly out in the open. It's sitting right there in the national the exit poll mission statement. Their concept of the value of their exit polls, and this is somewhat disingenuous, I have to say, but their idea is that they're information sources for academic analysis primarily. How did this group of voters vote? What was the motivation, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, that's their idea. And Matofsky many times when he was alive said, you know, these are not meant as a check mechanism or anything like that. They didn't want to take responsibility, for bringing down a president or
and questioning the legitimacy of the government. They say, well, if this percentage of people wanted this, but they voted for Kerry, for example, and a lesser percentage voted for Bush, we'll actually increase the numbers of the Bush voters because, after all, that's what the official results are.
It's based on the idea that the official results are gospel. It's accepted that the official results are the truth, are accurate, and then at a certain point, once the polls close and they begin to get the data from the official results, they run it through the computers, and basically the exit polls are adjusted to match that, and that creates some significant demographic distortions in the exit polls, and that's one of the footprints of election rigging, are these demographic distortions.
You mean like less African Americans vote than otherwise voted, or things like that?
Yeah, and a few others that I can get into.
But that would be a demographic distortion.
Yeah, that would be one. Party ID would be another.
So, other words, fewer people, there are more people who are Democrats than we know because they distort the numbers down to decrease the vote.
Yes, and furthermore, when that continues election after election with rigged elections, that effect tends to be cumulative. In the sense that everything gets based on a previous picture. The exit polls
that was
for
inaccurate to
election
begin with.
2008 are going to be based on the supposed turnout profile for 2006, which was based on the official results.
Well, let's get back to 2006. I'm well aware of what happened in 2004.
Right.
I'm less aware of 2006.
Okay. In 2006, as I said, we were sitting in the war room, and you know, we kind of just more or less on a bit of a lark, we decided, well, let's see what CNN has tonight on these exit polls. We did not think there would be unadjusted exit polls. We thought that it was going to be blank until they gave you the figures that conformed to the official votes. That was not the case. They put out a 7 p.m. national exit poll for all the House races aggregate.
So they added all the votes for all the House races.
Very similar to the exit poll for the popular vote for president in a presidential year.
And what was the result?
Okay. What we found was that in that exit poll from 7 p.m. that was authentic, the Democrats had a margin of about 11.5%. The official totals, they wound up with a margin of 7.6%. That's about a 4% difference, and that represents 3 million votes.
So it went from about 56-44 to about 54-46, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, those aren't the exact numbers, but it was a 4% net difference,
right,
which represents 3 million votes nationwide in the election, which is quite a number of votes, even if they were randomly distributed.
Now, Jonathan, the argument Republicans always make, and I don't know that there's any basis for it, is that, well, the exit polls are based on the early voting results, and maybe late voters are all Republican.
Well, yeah, that's a fairly trivial argument. Usually the argument that I've heard that's made, and we fought over it in 2004, was basically, well, the exit polls oversample Democrats because the interviewers are college kids or they're disproportionately black, or Bush voters are more hostile and more less willing to... All right, what that misses is the fact that this is... We're not talking about raw data. Exit polls, I have to admit, I mean, it's about a 40-year... experience
science.
With exit poll science, and they've gotten very good at it, but we still have to admit that what is taken as raw data is not what comes out over your TV screen. I mean, they put it through a whole series of demographic filters, and those filters try to get it right in terms of what the actual turnout was, who went to the polls, and they base that on voting patterns from the past. It's quite sophisticated.
Well, let me ask you this. So just the specific argument about 7 p.m. would be, hey, polls close at 7 p.m., 8 p.m. in some states.
Yep.
The last hour of voters are overwhelmingly Republican. Have they tested for that?
No. Yeah, no. The 7:07 exit polls, I mean, basically impounded everything up till about 7 o'clock. That's not what happens. When they adjust the exit polls, they're very upfront about the fact that it's not a bunch of voters coming in late or anything like that. It's basically they're taking, you know, if Kerry got too many votes in the exit polls, they downweight all the questionnaires that indicate they voted for Kerry. I mean, it's just a weighting procedure. It's like they call it forcing. And it's a forced weighting procedure to make it match the poll. So there really isn't any secret around that. What happened, what was different in 2006 from 2004 is when they ask these exit polls, they don't just ask voter preference. They don't ask who you're voting for. They ask a whole battery of questions. And it's like 16 pages worth of questions. Union, household, age, party ID, income,
race,
when
religion.
You made up your mind, race, religion, evangelical, approval ratings, et cetera, et cetera. So you get a very, very detailed...
And so they can make sure it tracks other polls.
That's right. They make sure that nothing is sticking out like a sore thumb. And when you're dealing with the kind of numbers that you're dealing with in a national exit poll, I mean, they're polling over 10,000 voters, which, for people who aren't familiar with statistics, you could say, well, isn't that kind of small? That is a huge sample. I mean, your average polls that are tracking polls or that are, you know, popularity polls or whatever, they're based on 1,500, 2,000 voters. When you get up to 10,000, you're looking at a margin of error less than 1%. It's a very, very, very accurate poll. The only question then becomes, is it a biased poll? Did they, in fact, interview too many Democrats? Did, you know, Republicans...
Too many women, too many blacks,
right.
Too many
Kerry
supporters.
Well, no, the women and blacks you can get pretty easily because that's right in the crosstabs. You can see how many women, how many blacks. Whatever. But the question of Democrats, there is always the issue. We know how many women there are in the country. You know how many women go to the polls. It's not clear what the turnout is. Are the Democrats winning the turnout battle or the Republicans winning? Well, in 2006, we had some yardsticks in the polls that were so open and shut and so clear. The media on election night, they saw these same polls. And they said, well, there we go again. We can't rely on the exit polls. They're off as usual. Guess what? They oversampled Democrats. They always oversample Democrats. End of story. They could have looked at the same figures we were looking at, and they could have, if they had dug just an inch deeper, come to a very different conclusion. Because that sample of over 10,000 voters, which basically stands for the national voting public, right? We wanted to see, did they oversample Democrats? And one sign of, let's say, if they oversampled Democrats, is these guys would have given Bush a very low approval rating. Or they would have said that in 2004, we voted for Kerry.
That makes
more
sense.
More than proportional.
Sure, sure.
Or there would have been not enough evangelical Christians,
or too
et
many
cetera,
union
et cetera.
Households.
Right. None of those things applied. And the one
so the sample that gave 11% to the Democrats...
11.5%
yeah, difference to the Democrats, about 56-44, more or less. That's 12 points.
Okay.
Close enough.
Yep.
Had the exact proportion of union households and blacks and women's and even people who approved of Bush... as the other national sample.
Well, it was actually a little better than that. I mean, union households, blacks, women, that was all pretty square. Matter of fact, it was slightly under what we expected in the turnout of the black vote. But the Bush approval was a real kicker because this sample... Now, if you remember, the tracking approval of Bush going into the election was mid-30s. It was about 35, 36.
Right, it's lower now.
Yeah, it's lower now. But going into the election is
mid-30s.
What we'd want to compare with.
Right.
Now, the... approval given by this sample to Bush was 42%.
Wow.
Now,
so if anything, they overrepresented Bush supporters.
Before you go wow too much, I have to make this caveat. This question was asked in the exit poll, was asked in a slightly different way from most tracking polls. It was asked as a four-point question. In other words, strongly approve, somewhat disapprove.
Right.
This has been tested as a format, and consistently, and Rasmussen has this in his, on his website, consistently it gives about a 3% higher approval rating than when you just ask approve, disapprove.
Okay, but even then, his number would be 38.
Right, or 39.
So it's still 3 points higher.
That's right.
So in other words,
than the
just to get
polls.
To the bottom line and out of the statistics, here you have a group of people that approved of Bush more than the general population, fit all the other demographic characteristics, whether it be race, religion, sex, union households, etc., income distribution, I assume, as well.
There were a disproportionate number of evangelical Christians in the sample.
Disproportionate number of evangelical
34%.
Christians.
Yes.
34%, whereas what's the proportion in the United States?
It's hard to, there's some disagreement, but it's around 20, 25.
So way, 10% above.
Way high.
And this poll said 11.5% for the Democrats.
Right. 3 million extra votes.
And yet they only got 7%. All right. That's very powerful evidence.
Yeah, it is.
That's the first part of the interview. Before I go on with the interview, I just want to make sure you haven't been lost in a stream of statistics. Part of the problem with really conveying election fraud is that it requires a whole bunch of statistics. And Republicans are very good at telling Americans, ignore the data, ignore the data, just listen to our rhetoric. Let me just make sure you understand what all those statistics proved, because it's very, very powerful stuff. Here's what he's saying. What he's saying is they did exit polls in 2006, and those exit polls showed that Democrats won by 11.5% margin. Pretty strong stuff, 11.5%. That's like 56 to 44, all right? It's a pretty strong victory. It's bigger than, say, you know, most of the landslides we've had. Bigger than, about the size of Reagan's landslide in 84. But the actual results only showed a 7% Democratic margin. So 4.5% off. Now, this is enough to affect, you know, probably 20 House seats. So where did all the voters go? Well, either there was election fraud, or the exit poll may have skewed toward Democrats. I mean, you know, exit polls can be wrong. Maybe they skewed toward Democrats. So we looked at the exit poll, and what did we discover? We discovered 10% higher evangelical Christians in the exit poll than there are in America. We discovered several points higher approval for George Bush than there is in America. In other words, this exit poll that gave an 11.5% swing to the Democrats was favored toward the Republicans. Maybe the swing was higher. Maybe it was 12% or 13%. It certainly didn't favor the Democrats to have Bush's approval rating higher than average, to have the number of evangelical voters higher than average. In other words, to make a very long story short, even an exit poll skewed toward Republicans shows that there was probably election fraud in 2006. It's a very, very serious issue, and sometimes you have to go through the data in order to understand what's going on. I'm going to play the second part of the interview in just a few moments, but if you want to call in, here's your chance to do so. The toll-free number is right there, 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. What are your thoughts? Was election 2006, which gave those wonderful Democratic victories, actually, was it skewed as well? Should we have had a landslide instead of a close victory? Let me hear from you. We'll be right back after this.
Sweetie, I love you, but those jeans have got to go.
Yeah, I know. Grab me a pair next time you go to the store, would you?
No.
Huh?
I'm not going there anymore. I can't stand it.
What do you mean?
It's just awful, honey. The only smile in that building is that big yellow face. Everybody else looks miserable, and I can't find anything there that's made in our country. That bothers me.
Well, nobody makes clothes in America anymore.
Au contraire, mi amigo. There's a ton of American-made clothing at No Sweat.
Well, where's this No Sweat store? Out at the mall?
No, silly. I found them at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. There's a link there. I already ordered some great workout gear, and I also got you some new jeans. They'll be here in a couple of days. Surprise.
HeadOnRadioNetwork.com?
Uh-huh. Just click on the No Sweat banner. You're right there. Helps union workers and helps support America's other liberal network. Cool, huh?
I knew listening to the horn was a good idea.
Whose idea?
Your idea, dear. All the good ones are.
Union made? No sweat. Great prices? No sweat. Great looks? No sweat. No sweat at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. Click the banner. Do the right thing.
It wasn't exactly planes, trains, and automobiles on Head On with Bob Kincaid.
This is what the Bush Administration Justice Department didn't want you to see back in 2001. They took out and they huffed the marker a little bit, and then they went, oh, cool. And they wiped out the name where it says, the plane was chartered either by the Saudi Arabian royalty family or Osama bin Laden. Somebody's got to call up and say, good afternoon. Thank you for calling Ryan International Flights. How may I help you?
Hello. This is Osama bin Laden, and I would like to rent a Boeing 727. Do you have one handy?
Oh, just a moment. Let me check. It's a Mr. bin Laden wants to know if we got a 727. Do we, Harry, do we have a 727?
Yeah, we got a 727 just sitting there on the lot. Going cheap.
There's nothing here. Nothing to look at. Keep moving. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. The, you know, the 6 foot 7 inch Arab with the portable dialysis machine and the white robes.
Head On with Bob Kincaid, weeknights, 6 to 9 p.m. Eastern, only on the Head On Radio Network.
From Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. Now, you know I'm not one to believe or even spout conspiracy theories. When people talk about electric charges, planted bombs bringing down the Twin Towers, I am the first to say I think that is completely unproven, and indeed I think it's false. I actually believe that those that follow the 9/11 conspiracy theories actually hurt the cause, because they mix by promoting what is, to me, far from proven, and in fact seems to me to be very unlikely, that by doing that, what they do is they help harm the cause for legitimate, real conspiracies that we can prove. Well, in the case of elections, there is nothing more important than our right to vote. We know 2000 was stolen. And now it seems that 06 may have been stolen as well. Now, I'm not saying it's proven. I'm just giving you the numbers. I'm giving you the evidence. But I'm not one to jump at conspiracy theories. But my guest, Jonathan Simon, has some pretty good, strong evidence. And now I've discovered, thanks to Yo, who let me know, that in 2004, we know that Ohio was the crucial state, right? If John Kerry had won Ohio, he would be president right now, and we'd be a heck of a lot better off. Well, now it's been reported on Alternet that in 56 of Ohio's 88 counties, all the ballots and election records from 2004 have been accidentally destroyed, despite a federal order to preserve them. That's right, two-thirds of Ohio counties have, oops, lost all their ballots. Well, I know what I would do if I were the court. I would round up all those election officials and throw them in jail. In jail. The only way they're going to learn the lesson. I think it's actually quite dangerous and quite possible that Ohio was stolen, that 2004 was stolen. But the whole purpose of having courts to preserve these ballots is to preserve our right to check it. That's why we need, in fact, to have paper records so that we don't have stolen elections again. Again, I've emphasized people who think they can sort of steal every election. No, I think what they can do is they can increase the percentage. I think it's very hard when you have a landslide to take away the landslide. For example, in 06, so many people voted for the Democrats that it was hard to get rid of all the evidence. Or, as my guest Jonathan Simon argues, maybe they just didn't think there would be this much of a landslide. We will get back to my interview with Jonathan Simon in just a second. First, let me go to Dave from California. Dave, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Well, Mark, a good thing may be happening here in California. I don't know if you've been following it, but our Secretary of State, Deborah Bowen, she's a good one. And over the past week, she's had hackers testing our machines here, and they were all failing miserably. That is, they were able to enter them all and flip votes any way they wanted. So she wanted to just get rid of them, came under all kinds of corporate pressure. So she said, good people of California, please tell me what you want me to do. She's given out a website, and so I share that, too, because I know you have California listeners. And
yeah, please do. What is that website?
She is the www.sos.ca.gov.
SOS.ca.gov. And Dave, I know you comment on my blog all the time. Why don't you go ahead and post that to the blog so that people have
that.
I have to tell you, Dave, to hear you praise an election official such as the California Secretary of State is a stunning development to find that there is an election official that you trust. Ladies and gentlemen, if Dave trusts the Secretary of State, she must indeed be a good woman and someone who's committed to fair and accurate voting.
I got a tough question for you, though, Mark.
Go ahead.
If as a fact, 911 was an inside job, would you want to know it?
Sure. But I haven't been convinced of it, Dave. I really haven't. And I fear, I've been through this several times, and I haven't heard anything new, frankly, in several years. And my fear, Dave, is that real, legitimate, dangerous conspiracies like hacking voting machines, things that legitimately change our lives and cause us to lose our democracy, in fact, treason, ultimate treason, this is severe stuff. And my fear is that discussions of the 9/11 conspiracies hide evidence of elections. And it's not so much that people mean to, but because people focus on what's already happened and what we can't change, they're not focusing on things we can change, such as election machinery. That at the end of the day, I have to say it's far more severe and important. I mean, I don't happen to believe the electric charges brought down the Twin Towers. I do think there are questions about 9/11 that are legitimate to ask, such as the scrambling of the planes and NORAD, why we let bin Laden's people go. They're definitely legitimate questions to ask. I'm not saying that. But I think those that say the electric charges brought down the building really just don't have any evidence of it. And I fear that it hides really important possible conspiracies, like my interview with Jonathan Simon, where he suggests, and I had never heard this before interviewing him, that maybe election 2006 was stolen as well.
Well, I think the world of you, Mark, but I'm going to tell you, on this particular thing, you are the twin brother of Sean Hannity. He says,
Oh, I am not! Dave, that's so harsh!
he says, I see no evidence of global warming. And you can dump a dump truck of it on him. And he says,
but
I see no evidence.
See evidence of global warming, Dave. What I don't see is evidence that somebody planted electric bombs in the World Trade Center. There's been no witness to that anywhere. The way the things have fallen, I have several friends who are engineers. They all explained to me, one even gave me the heat constant to show me how the jet fuel would have melted along with the pressure to make the building fall down. These are friends of mine. These are Democrats. These are not people who have any agenda. I don't think they're spies. I believe that the planes hit the buildings and the jet fuel caused them all to fall, just as we said. And I don't think you need to argue that it was Bush causing 9/11 to make the obvious argument that he has used 9/11 in a very cynical way to convince us to go to war in Iraq. Now, that's true. No question, that's true. But you don't have to argue that he actually planted the bombs to come to that conclusion.
Cheney did it. They sent Bush away to read a book about pet goats or something. But
well, Dave, you and I are going to have to disagree on this one. But I do want to thank you for calling in, and I want to focus on the conspiracies I can prove. And frankly, this one on the voting machines I find extremely dangerous and worthy of people's attention. Thanks for calling in, Dave.
Thank you.
Let me go back to continue my interview with Jonathan Simon because, again, our voting, to me, is far more important. Whatever you think of 9/11, this is far more important. This relates not just to our past, but to our future, particularly our future as a democracy. Let's continue the interview.
This kind of reminds me of old civil rights cases, and I don't know, you're probably familiar with this, but there's an old distance in the law. They call it disparate impact and disparate treatment. And basically what the law says is it used to say if you can prove that, hey, here's this industry and it's way overrepresentation of white people and very few blacks and women, that they're discriminating. But then they said, no, that's just statistics.
Right.
You got to prove it. So here's my question to you. I'm very impressed by this. But until we put people in jail, and I'd love to put people in jail for this.
Well, there are some people in jail in Ohio, and there are probably some more to follow.
Not near enough.
Right.
Whoever stole 3 million votes, I advocate the death penalty. But that's my own personal thing.
I wouldn't go that far, but death penalty.
I consider it treason.
Yeah.
But we can talk about it another time. How do you prove it? I mean, is this Diebold paperless ballots that are causing this? Is this stuffing the ballot box in the old way? What's doing this? Is it the old Clint Curtis use software to manipulate the system, or all of the above?
Well, as you know from those civil rights cases, when they changed the standard to intent, those civil rights cases became very, very hard.
Very hard to prove.
So that's a big part of it. Now
you have to get the guy in the back room saying, I hate them men people, basically. Yeah,
right, exactly. Sure. So, you know, that's by using a process approach to change the burden of proof, you can basically kill off anything. I mean, I've often said, what the hell do they want? Do they want us to bring a DRE into the room, waterboard it, and make it sign a confession that, hey, I'm rigged? We're not going to get that. The kicker here is that the hard evidence, what you would call the non-statistical hard evidence, memory cards and machines, this is all safeguarded as proprietary. The courts will not let election integrity advocates or candidates even get at this information. This happened to Christine Jennings. I mean, you can't actually get at the hard evidence.
She tried to subpoena the actual memory cards in Florida, and they said no?
The court said no. I mean, I'm not an expert on that case, but they were rejected in their attempt to actually look at the machines and what was inside the machines. It was regarded as proprietary property of the
only
of the
in
vendors.
America is an election to choose who chooses our leadership a private affair.
Well,
in
probably in Myanmar as well, and you know,
yeah, I mean,
Sudan,
yeah, in most countries on earth, they understand that choosing who runs your country is inherently a public thing, not a private thing.
Yeah.
In terms of fixes, and we've had a whole discussion that we don't need to go into on Rush Holt's bill before this, but would that bill fix at least this problem of being able to subpoena information and make it non-proprietary for election machinery?
Yes and no. Most of us believe that the Holt bill has been written in a rather clever way. We're not sure about what the motives are. We believe that it's been set up to allow a certain amount of disclosure, but basically to shut the door at which it becomes public, because written into this and federalized really for the first time in this area are the fact that anybody who looks at this, I mean, there's a qualified list of experts and whatnot that are allowed to look at this, but they have to sign non-disclosure agreements. Basically, if they find smelly cheese, they can't go public about it. If they find memory cards, if they find evidence of rigging, they're bound by non-disclosure agreements, which previously were contractual, so they came up under state law and were somewhat susceptible to litigation. When you put it into this federal law like this, you remove a lot of those opportunities. So there are those in our movement who are actually saying that sort of under cover of seeming to offer some sort of public disclosure, the whole bill actually federalizes secret vote counting.
I tell you what, after this interview, I'm going to insist that Jonathan Simon show me exactly what he's talking about, because if my listeners know, I do know people in Rush Holt's office and other places, and I can't speak for all of Congress or even all the Democrats in Congress, but I do think he at least is out to do the right thing. And so I'm going to show me what you're talking about, and I'll be happy to do it. One thing, of course, non-disclosure agreement didn't prevent is a certain tobacco lobbyist for Brown and Williams to say, hey, I care about the country more than I care about these agreements. And he was, you know, ridden on a rail, but I would hope that at least people who look into this thing, if they saw a rigged card, if they saw criminal activity, they would have a privilege to report it to authorities.
Well, you know, that's one of the reasons why I'm an agnostic on the Holt bill, in spite of my organization's opposition to it, because I feel there's too much uncertainty to be able to say with definitively how it would play out. So that's why I, you know, maintain an agnostic stance. And I'm not agnostic about too many things. But I look at this, and there's so many variables involved. It's not clear. But I will say this, that, you know, in a schematic sense or a very broad spectrum sense, there does seem to be a will among the elites of this society, the power elites, not to let the public in the door. I mean, there is, for a democracy, a tremendous distrust of the public will, of the public knowing too much, of the public inserting itself where it really isn't wanted. And that's not just the neocons. It's
no.
The Democratic Party as well.
Well, let me make a suggestion to you as a member of that party. Has the Election Defense, and you probably have already done this, at least I hope you have, has the Election Defense Alliance put out an alternative plan or amendments to Holt's bill that you would suggest and presented it to the congressman and to other Democrats?
Well, yes, we have. I mean, we haven't put it out in the legal language of a finished form of Holt's bill, but we have put it out in a series of points and bullet points that we would like to see.
Put it in the legal language.
We would like to see.
Just throwing that out.
As
a former lawyer who worked for Congress, put it in the legal language and people will actually look at it and take it seriously.
Yeah, no, I agree with that, and we've been advocating that. Of course, I mean, you're looking at a significant budgetary gap between the Congress and some of the major organizations.
No question.
And those of us who can, you know, barely hire ourselves, well, actually, we're all volunteer and unpaid, but the idea of, you know, getting somebody who's an expert on this and paying them $300 an hour to draft language is somewhat beyond our means and our scope. But I do agree with you that this needs to be done. And one of the vehicles for that is Dennis Kucinich and reintroducing his bill from H.R. 6200 that basically calls for hand-counted paper ballots for the federal races, or at least for the presidential race. Likelihood of such a bill passing or even making it out of committee is very, very low, but it does give a focal point, a rallying point for the election integrity community, which is growing, to rally around and say this is what we really want. In this area, I mean, changes are not linear in this area. There are critical mass issues. When it begins to come out, anything that involves the mainstream media, you know, you get drip, 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 and then all of a sudden a flood of attention. That's what we're playing for. I mean, we're playing for the truth of this issue to come out. And, you know, just to bring that around to 2006 again, one of the very obvious questions that was asked was, well, why would the Republicans rig and lose, or why would those who favor the
obviously
Republicans...
Obviously, they can only rig... One thing I've always been telling my listeners, you can only rig to a certain extent.
Well, we don't think that's the answer, Mark.
No,
actually.
Really? I don't think you can rig
answer.
20%.
We think you can rig 20%. We think that the algorithm for intelligent rigging is rig only as much as you need, because obviously after that, from a cost-benefit analysis standpoint,
yeah, right.
Everything
win
you rig is just risk.
Right.
So you win close elections, and you win only the number of elections that you need to keep power. I mean, this is a very bottom-line business, right? And
because after all, if you get caught, there's criminal sanctions and other things.
Well, criminal sanctions, plus you blow the lid off the whole thing, and you destabilize the country, and you have illegitimate government.
Okay.
I mean, there's some very serious consequences. So we believe the algorithm is rig only what you need. Now, the rig, as of 2006, I can't say what we're going to see in 2008 or 2012 or whatever, but assuming we're still having elections in 2008 and 2012, but the rigging mechanism is a very, it's a real-time mechanism. In other words, you can't just wave your magic wand on election night from some satellite someplace.
Don't you have to rig county by county? I mean, it's a lot of work.
Yeah, you basically have to go...
I mean, this is not some little conspiracy here.
No,
it requires hundreds of people, wouldn't it?
Not true. That's the other part of this. You can duplicate these memory cards. You can centrally create, program, and infect these memory cards in such a way that those who are installing the memory cards have no idea that they're installing malicious code, that they're installing rigged cards.
So in other words, all you need is one executive at Diebold, and all the Diebold machines are rigged.
That's the conclusion that the GAO or the Brennan Center both came to, that this can be done with a very, very
small... But it can only be done with certain machines, right?
Well, we're not sure. You know, we opscans are vulnerable. DREs are vulnerable.
Opscans are vulnerable.
Yeah,
but if they count the paper record and it's different from the official count, then we know it's rigged.
Yes, and you know, and if my mother had wheels, she'd be a bus. They don't count the paper record. Those paper records, in 99.999% of the cases, sit there, you know, kept for 22 months. Anybody seeking a recount is batted away by prohibitive cost or some
regulation. Can FOIA get at those ballots? The Freedom of Information Act?
As far as I know, no, but I'm not an expert on that. That's okay. Actually a very good question. The attempt has been made to get at a lot of ballots, and it has not been successful for the most part. But the question that, you know, I want to go back to is, all right, so why would they rig and lose? Because let's face it, election 2006, the Democrats won, and that took a lot of steam out of the concern, you know, the threat level seemed to go from red to yellow overnight, you know. It was really a double-edged sword for those of us
okay,
in election.
Okay, so answer that question. Why would they rig an election and lose?
All right, Mike, the answer to that question can be found in the Cook political report, Charlie Cook. He does tracking surveys, and he's very mainstream.
Yes,
very
he is.
Mainline.
Absolutely.
And if you look in that report, in the month of October, if you remember Mark Foley and Reverend Haggard
certainly.
And a few other things,
certainly.
A lot of things hit the fan in
yes,
the month of
did.
October. At the beginning of October, first week in October, the Democratic margin in the generic congressional ballot, who are you going to vote for Congress, Democrat, Republican, was 9% among most likely voters. By the last week of October, that margin was 26%.
Wow.
That is an explosion. That is a lead balloon dropping through the floor and going to hell.
Right.
That was what happened to the Republicans in October. The rig, as such as it was, this is not something you can just go around to all the machines in October.
In other words, they calculated it 15%, but they couldn't calculate it.
They calculated too early, and there was no opportunity to recalibrate. And so the rig that was in place, the 3 million votes, and we have other work that I haven't gone into that was specifically showed through exit polling of our own that the competitive races were targeted. The vote shift in competitive races was significantly greater than in non-competitive
races. Right.
In fact,
some of the races the Republicans lost weren't the competitive races.
Right.
So they weren't even watching those, and they lost those.
Right. That's what happened. But what we found was that the 3 million votes that were shifted, if the election had been held as anticipated, first week of October, with the prevailing dynamics at that time, the Republicans would have held both houses of Congress.
Interesting. Very interesting. Hey, one last thing, and we've had a very long interview.
I've enjoyed it. Such as, you know, to the extent that you can enjoy any of this.
One of the main points you make is it's obviously not just a problem with Congress. It's a problem with the media. I mean, Congress and the media, frankly, if the media were all over this, Congress would be all over this. That's how it works, you know. One woman is sick in Florida, and the media focuses on Terri Schiavo, and suddenly Congress focuses on Terri Schiavo. It seems to me that the media blackout is as harmful, perhaps, as the congressional blackout. I mean, it's symbiosis. One affects the other. What can you do? What can election organizations do to get mainstream media to pay attention? Tough question,
you got,
huh?
You got
I got silence
least,
on the other end here.
10 seconds of dead air time there. Look.
You come on the Inside Scoop and you help promote progressive media. That's what you do.
That sounds like a good plan. Within 9 days of the 2006 election, my colleague Bruce O'Dell and I had published Landslide Denied. We put it out on our website. It came out on Op-Ed News, and it basically explains what I've just told you about the October surprise and about the exit polls and the validation, self-validation of the exit polls. We sent that out through U.S. Newswire to over 800 media outlets. It was picked up as a three-line passing reference by one newspaper, I believe in North Dakota. It might have been South Dakota. That was it. We offered it as a scoop, as a exclusive to Lou Dobbs, to Keith Olbermann, et cetera, et cetera.
Keith Olbermann did not pick it up.
Not even a response. That's how tight this lockdown is. I mean, Paul Krugman could tell you plenty of things about the environment about these things.
Let me suggest to you that I'm a member of the Head On Radio Network, and we at The Horn would love to have you back on my show, on the other host. Call us, and let's talk about this more often, because this is an issue that very much concerns our listeners. They talk about it all the time, and the details matter. That's one reason why we had such a long interview.
And that's part of it, is the devil, to a large extent, is in the details. That's what people's eyes tend to glaze over.
Let me suggest
over,
to you,
they do matter.
Here's the problem. If you give somebody a 30-second story, which is usually all they'll give you on CNN, it sounds like a conspiracy theory. It doesn't make sense. And if you can explain it in 30 minutes, well, that's too long. I'm sorry, we can't have you.
And the other thing about the media is that if you notice the pattern, and Lou Dobbs did some great work on this up to the election, and this is the pattern that I predicted that we've seen now several cycles in a row. In the run-up to the election for a month or two, there will be story after story. I mean, you look at Lou Dobbs. Can't we trust electronic voting? Who's? I mean, he even
right,
had
right.
Some
he had
some
them. I remember.
People on
I remember
on election
them.
Night. He
I remember
had,
Lou
had,
Dobbs.
Yeah,
right.
He had Harvey Wasserman on. Or
I
whatever,
remember.
Right.
Foster I remember. Trakus.
Peter Pekarsky, I mean, people who are really strong in, you know, conspiracy theorists, if you want to call us that. And he was all over this, and Keith Olbermann a little bit, too. On election night and following, blackout. That's it. It ends there. So they have done
why,
that.
Why, Jonathan? Why? I mean, Keith Olbermann, I have no reason to doubt his integrity. He seems to be very good on a number of issues. I don't know him personally, but why would Keith Olbermann not run this story? I don't get it.
Well,
what do they tell you behind the scenes? Do they tell you anything? Do they even respond to you?
A lot of
scenes?
Times we literally don't get a response. I've had correspondence with Keith, and he's usually pretty gracious.
Why won't he cover this?
We don't know. I mean, our best guess is that if you look at the consequences of bringing this out, I mean, the two real untouchables at this point is what happened on 9/11 and election rigging at this point. Anything else you can pretty much touch. But, you know, including the attorney, you know, the attorney general
sure,
firings
sure,
and all
sure,
that
I've
stuff.
Covered
but
all
this
that.
Stuff, you blow the lid off of this. And basically, I guess, you know, you're looking at a significant destabilization of...
Well, you're saying that our government for the past how many years has been a farce. It's undemocratic.
And what that would do to the economy and what that would do to, you know, sort of Pax Americana, such as it is. You know, I think it's just too much to contemplate. And, you know, these media journalists have a certain degree of independence, but it's certainly less than it was at one time. You look at the parent corporations of these networks, and you got GE, and you've got Disney, and you've got Viacom, et cetera, et cetera.
I hear you.
You know, we don't know what the chain of command is. We don't know. You know, we're not on the inside. We're on the outside looking in. We just know that, we're not getting dialogue on this. We're not getting correspondence on this from the media or from the Congress. People in Congress who you normally, you know, would expect would be all over this are very, very reluctant. We could not get landslide denied into the record of the Senate Rules Committee hearings, the House Administration Committee hearings.
Can you probably get it inserted in the Senate record, a House record by Dennis Kucinich. At least he'd throw it in there.
We're going to try, although even Dennis, I mean, Dennis has been slow to reintroduce his bill. You know, he's gone for the impeachment. I mean,
right.
Even impeachment seems to, you know, be
less controversial than an election rigging.
That's right. Because, you know, what could be more destabilizing
sure.
to a democracy? And then what do you do about it? Nobody ever wants to look back and talk about a stolen election. They're always looking forward and saying, well, how can we make the next election fair and honest?
Right.
But without looking back and without recognizing, you know, and again, from a public standpoint, one of the ways we put this is to say, look, if you were to ask somebody to give up their 10 favorite foods, you know, because one day they might get a heart attack, you're not going to get a lot of compliance. But if they've had a heart attack and they
right.
realize they've had a heart attack, you're going to get a lot more compliance. Unless we can demonstrate that this is happening, as long as it's just sort of a vulnerability or a hypothetical, it's very hard to get the serious attention and the reform that would
You've
work.
Got to catch just one Diebold CEO torturing, well, not that I'm advocating torture, but get one person to, I mean, we had Clint Curtis, who was pretty good on this. Get some more people, throw some people in jail, and suddenly you can have a revolution in this country. Jonathan Simon, thank you for coming here on the Inside Scoop, spending time with us. You are welcome to come back here or anywhere on the Head On Radio Network. We're glad to have you. Thanks for coming.
Thanks very much for your time, Mark. I enjoyed it.
Well, I hope you enjoyed the interview. I think Jonathan Simon raises some very, very important issues. First of all, the first half of the interview, if you came in late, was the proof, was the evidence, pretty strong evidence based on exit polls that it's not just 2000 and it's not just 2004, but 06. Even the election which the Democrats won, they should have won overwhelmingly because that's how the people voted. But it's very, very hard to get this media attention. That's why I spend so much time on it. That's why this is my pet issue. I've even been accused of raising it too much, but that won't stop me because it's vital. Vital to our democracy. It is the very essence of democracy. But then sometimes I get people, they come to me with the exact wrong conclusion from this. There are people on the left and they say, well, then I'm just not going to vote. If my vote's not going to be counted, I'm just not going to vote. Boy, would you be wrong. If you've learned anything from Jonathan Simon, it should be that sometimes they don't plan to rig it enough. Last time he thinks they may have rigged it 7 to 9 points, but people voted 16 points, so we got a 7-point swing. Look, my friends, to say that the system is corrupt is it's obvious. Like, we all know the system is corrupt. But to say, hey, I'm not going to participate in the system because it's corrupt, well then, my friend, you are part of the problem. The way to fight a corrupt system is to, one, inform people, and that's what I try to do. That's what Bob Kincaid and Guy James and everyone else on the horn tries to do, to let you know the truth. And then number two is up to you, my friends, and that is to take action. Call your member of Congress, demonstrate in the streets. A lot of these things, frankly, are done at the local level. That's what voting is, done at the local level. And that's why Dave's insight into the Secretary of State of California is very important as well. We have to understand, we have to work hard. Just a few phone calls. If you haven't called your member of Congress and your state legislator, on the issue of voting, on the issue of voter verified paper records, then what are you waiting for? It's just a phone call, but you owe it to your democracy. That's it for the Inside Scoop. Tune in tomorrow for more of the Inside Scoop and the news government does not want you to know. This is Mark Levine signing off.